So one of the things is the USFL comes about when, you know, those both men are really struggling to earn respect from their respective teams. For Vince, it's, you know, Mike Ditka comes in 1982 and really doesn't like Vince Evans. They pick Jim McMahon. And then the following year in 1983, Vince in the middle of the season just makes the decision, you know, I'm done with this. I'm not getting a chance. They're never going to play me. And so he goes to play for the Chicago Blitz. And when he signs his contract, he's one of the highest paid quarterbacks in all of football, regardless of where they're at. Because the Blitz understood the appeal of Vince Evans, that he's fast, he's electrifying, and we need to sell tickets. Vince in Chicago. And they got a new coach, Marv Levy, and they're going to try all of his experience with him. It doesn't work out. The next year, he's with the Denver Gold. Does pretty well, but then the following year, USFL is done. Doug is in a similar situation. Doug leaves in before the 1983 season, but he leaves because the owner of his team at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, is, as Doug says it a number of times in real time and in his autobiography, he's a racist. And he wouldn't pay Doug his worth. Doug, by the time he's a, you know, a free agent negotiating his contract, he's about the 54th highest paid quarterback in the league. Yet he's one of the top players in the league. And the ownership wouldn't budge off a contract. Doug wanted $600,000. They only wanted to give him $400,000. This is at a time when, you know, some of the guys are starting to sign million-dollar contracts. And he says, I'm done. And the Oklahoma team and the USFL gives him a contract, pays him what he wants, pays him what he's worth. And he goes over there, plays in Oklahoma one year. That franchise eventually moves to Arizona. He plays there. And then, like with Vince, he's out of football because the USFL is done.
Now, there were some disparaging remarks made by some notable sports analysts. Talk to us about that brought this particular issue to the forefront again.
Again. Are we talking about the one that used to be on? Oh, Camp Hannis. I thought we were talking about Skip Bayless. Okay, Camp Hannis.
Oh, so, well, we're not going to talk about Skip on the
show.
We're
not going to do that. So, I'll Camp Hannis. So it's 1987.
Right.
It's Jackie Robinson Day, and he's on the news, mainstream news, and they're talking about black leadership. And all of a sudden, he goes off on some racist rant, right? And luckily, the white folks at the station at that time, there's a sports writer, there's a newscaster kind of call him out on his stuff. But he goes on a rant about, you know, lack of intelligence, leadership skills, but also something about swimming, how black people can't swim. And it really raises a dialogue in America about black leadership. And I think the key about this book is to understand, even if you're not a football fan, this book is really about, you know, the promise of civil rights, right? That merit's going to matter and that black people can climb this ladder in business world. And so a lot of folks look to the quarterback as the main leader. They're the most popular folks. I would say if we're in 1987, you know, obviously Jesse Jackson is gearing up for a run. He has some popularity. But it's those quarterbacks like Randall, Warren Moon, and eventually Doug leaning into the Super Bowl that are what really get people, right? What people are really watching. And the fact that there's no black leadership in really those major sports of baseball and football really speaks to what Al Capanis, who was at that time working for the Los Angeles Dodgers, is saying. And it really creates this atmosphere for folks to have a dialogue about race. But the NFL kind of just pushes it aside. They're like, we're not dealing with this. Eventually, they'll hire a black coach in Art Shell. You know, eventually Doug will get his chance with that. I think that's probably one of the most important moments in all of sports, right, where he stuck his foot in his mouth, started talking about racism, got called out for it, but also opens up this dialogue.
Dr. Lewis Moore, professor of history at Grand Valley State University, historian, co-host of the Black Athlete Podcast, and author of The Great Black Hope, Doug Williams, Vince Evans, and The Making of the Black Quarterback. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
In Black America and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows on the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr.
Help protect your family from flu this season by taking three easy steps. First, get yourself and your family a flu shot. It's quick and can protect you all season. Second, take everyday actions to help prevent the spread of germs, like flu. Cover your mouth. Stay home from work or school if you're sick, and wash your hands often. Third, there are drugs that can treat flu illness. These work best when started early. Learn more at cdc.gov/fightflu.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives. Today, we also face a mental health pandemic that threatens our well-being as we attempt to rebuild our social networks and communities.
The pandemic has reminded us to value family, community, and our human connections. However, it has also left many of us feeling more isolated, confused, and alone, struggling to find meaning amid loss and uncertainty.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges. But many of us do not understand what we are facing or know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we understand what you are going through, and we are here to help. Our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all. We work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health. If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
The cost of housing has risen sharply in recent years, including for college students. Living in a dorm or renting an off-campus apartment can be the single largest expense a student faces, even more than tuition. Laura Barone-Lopez reports on how students are coping with the high cost of living and how some universities are responding. It's the first part of our fall series, Rethinking College.
Senior Adrian Aguilar is studying civil engineering, but one of the biggest stressors during his time at the University of Texas at Austin has not been academics. It's how much he has to pay in rent.
When you left home to go to college, did you ever expect to have to worry this much about housing?
Not at all. I didn't think that it was customary for each person to be paying over $1,000 for decent apartments. I just didn't know.
Aguilar was raised in a rural city south of Houston by parents who immigrated from Guatemala. He has scholarships and financial aid to cover tuition and get some help from his parents. But it's never been enough to cover his rent.
I definitely need a job now to afford housing here, which it does eat it into my time, but that's just the reality of the situation.
Last year, Aguilar paid about $1,000 a month for a room in an off-campus apartment that had no natural light in the common areas, but it was walking distance to campus. This year, he's on the southeast side of Austin, paying about $200 less each month. He says it's far less depressing. But now, getting to class is a 20-minute drive, followed by a more than 30-minute walk.
And I'm lucky because the engineering center is the closest to the parking lots, so I can't imagine somebody who has classes more south of campus.
For more than a decade, Austin has been one of the fastest-growing metro areas in the country. Though down from pandemic-level highs, average rents are still 20% higher than they were 5 years ago.
Back when I was in school, that one building, the Castilian, was the only one still here. And you could actually see all the hills.
Jay Hartzell is the president of the University of Texas at Austin. And he acknowledges that housing is a major concern for students.
We are, in some ways, a huge beneficiary of the boom of Austin. I think we're part of that. But that growth has a cost, and we've seen prices go up.
At the University of Texas, the cost of tuition has actually fallen 16% over the last 5 years. But like many four-year public universities across the country, the cost of room and board is now higher than tuition for in-state students.
Tuition is so observable. People see it on a website. They are comparison shopping different universities to think about how much tuition is going to cost. But housing might be something they don't discover till later.
What do you think could alleviate some of the cost of housing?
I think, in some sense, as an economist, there's no substitute for more supply.
The university is building more housing. New graduate apartments are going up, and a 1,000-bed dorm for undergraduates is replacing an older, smaller one. But with less than 10,000 beds available for students on campus, the vast majority of UT's 42,000 undergraduates are in Austin's private housing market.
Generally, the thing that people are worried about is affordability.
Developers know that students are a vulnerable population, and because of that, there's a rise in rents every year.
Nimrotha Thirkadam and Kayla Kilantonk are both undergraduates in UT's architecture program and two of the leaders of the university's tenants union, which formed this past spring. The group successfully lobbied Austin to ban windowless bedrooms and is now hoping to be a long-term resource for students navigating housing at UT.
Do you think that the university has done enough?
When there are students living in windowless bedrooms, when there are students that are living in conditions with mold or being forced to move out early and find an attorney or find housing solutions themselves, it seems like there needs to be more of a responsibility taken on the university's side.
There are affordable options, and I think that students get overwhelmed and they don't know what to do and they want to rely on their university, but we're not being given enough resources.
We worry about our students' outcomes and work fiercely on their behalf, but we also realize that we are in this big city with a lot of different kinds of providers of housing, and it's going to be up to, in many ways, the city to figure out how to regulate all of that.
The cost of housing in growing Austin is not unique. Nationally, nearly one in two students experience some form of housing insecurity, according to surveys from the Hope Center at Temple University.
We see this housing crisis that exists across our country, but rendered one in 12 students experiencing homelessness.
Mark Huelsman is the center's director of policy and advocacy.
Most students are not the 18-year-old coming straight from high school onto campus, living on campus. Most students are commuter students. They're working sometimes full-time while enrolled in college. And these students are often on their own, and they're often on their own without the support of the federal government and without the support of sufficient financial aid.
Pell Grants, which are the largest federal support for low-income college students, can be used for non-tuition expenses like housing. But Huelsman says those grants only cover so much.
The Pell Grants purchasing power covers less of the percentage of college costs than it ever has since its inception. So what that means is students are taking on greater debt, they're working longer hours, they're either putting themselves currently behind the eight ball financially or in the future through higher debt.
25% of our student body are Pell Grant eligible.
At UT, President Jay Hartzell says the university has provided more financial support for student housing. In 2023, UT launched a new housing scholarship. This year, it's providing up to $2,300 a year for more than 3,000 middle and low-income students living on campus.
The goal is to use the aid as a tool to help students find it more affordable to live close to campus, because in our experience, students live closer do better.
Junior Ashanti Meredith, originally from Dallas, the cost of housing at UT caught her by surprise.
Nothing could have prepared me for how much I would have had to pay just for housing alone.
Meredith is a chemistry major and an aspiring doctor who has lived on campus all 3 years. Even though financial aid covers her tuition and some of her housing, coming up with the balance and getting a job. But for the last 2 years, she's gotten a financial boost from the university scholarship.
I was ecstatic because it really helped reduce the amount of loans I would have to take out to pay for my housing and allowed me to just focus 100% of my time on just my academics and not having to worry when the next bill is due.
Despite high rent, Meredith has no regrets about attending UT, a sentiment echoed by senior Adrian Aguilar. But he says the cost of housing is weighing heavily on what he might do after graduation.
Austin, it is a nice city, but I don't really want to worry about losing another $1,000 a month every month minimum. Going back home and living with my parents is a very tempting idea.
A decision driven by housing costs that could affect the vibrancy of Austin. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Laura Barone-Lopez on the campus of UT Austin.
Homes swept away, roads, many of them made impassable, livelihoods destroyed. There are people right now wondering whether or not or how they'll ever get back on their feet. Having already directed FEMA and other federal assets to attend hard-hit communities. Oh, here's Vice President Harris at FEMA. Let's listen.
Hey, everyone. Deputy Administrator Hooks, I thank you and everyone here for their leadership. As I said briefly, I know who is here. I know what you each do. And you are so selfless in the way that you serve our country. And in particular, at times like this, people who are just so desperately in need of help, support, and just knowing that the resources are going to be expedited to them as they need it in their most vulnerable situation, when their families have been at risk, where their homes may have been destroyed, where they lack just basic essential needs. You all do that work around the clock as though these are your family members. I know how you work and I know how hard you work. So I am here mostly to thank you all for all that you do, everyone who is here and everyone who's on the ground in the region at the moment. And I am here to also talk about where we are based on the briefings I have been receiving over the last couple of days. I have received regular briefings on the impact of Hurricane Helene, including from Administrator Criswell. And over the past 24 hours, I have spoken with Governor Kemp of Georgia, Governor Cooper of North Carolina, and many local officials. I have shared with them that we will do everything in our power to help communities respond and recover. And I've shared with them that I plan to be on the ground as soon as possible, but as soon as possible without disrupting any emergency response operations, because that must be the highest priority in the first order of business. The devastation from Hurricane Helene is immense. Millions of Americans are without power. Thousands of families have lost their homes. Entire neighborhoods have been destroyed. Major roads have been blocked or damaged, leaving entire towns inaccessible at this very moment. Already, nearly 100 people have been confirmed dead, and hundreds more are missing. The destruction we have seen in Alabama, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia is heartbreaking. In coordination with state and local officials, President Biden and I will continue to make sure that communities have the support and the resources that they need, not only to respond to this storm and its immediate aftermath, but also the resources they will need to recover. So far, more than 3,300 federal personnel are on the ground to assist with recovery efforts. They are deploying food, water, and generators. And we continue to work with teams on the ground to restore water and power as quickly as possible. To everyone who has been impacted by this storm, and to all of those of you who are rightly feeling overwhelmed by the destruction and the loss, our nation is with you. And President Biden and I, and all of the folks behind me, are with you. We will continue to do everything we can to help you recover and to help you rebuild, no matter how long it takes. And I do believe the true character of a nation is revealed in moments of hardship. Over the past few days, our nation has endured some of the worst destruction and devastation that we have seen in quite some time. And we have responded with our best, with the best folks who are on the ground and here doing the kind of work that is about rising to a moment of crisis to do everything we can to lift up folks who deserve to be seen and heard. Communities have been coming together. People are checking in on their neighbors. Families are opening their doors to strangers in need. And as they always do, our first responders are working around the clock, putting their own lives at risk to keep our communities safe. Moments like this remind us we have so much more in common than what separates us. And the true measure of our leadership, each one of us, is based on lifting other folks up, knowing how we can make a difference. So I thank everyone for rising to this moment, and I thank you all here for the work that you each do. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
We've been watching Vice President Kamala Harris at FEMA headquarters. Watching along with us, MSNBC columnist and contributor Charlie Sykes is here. Also with us, the president of Media Matters for America, Angela Carasone, is back. And with me at the table, Democratic Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett of Texas. Congresswoman, I start with you. This is the thing that you carry with you, the plight of your constituents. These are folks who are truly, truly hurting and suffering, and the vice president gave some voice to that today.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really important that she does come out and explain that she is absolutely on top of it, because there may be those that expect her to kind of show up in these spaces. But if you've ever been anywhere that the president or the vice president is, you know how many local resources are drained because they have to keep them secure. And so I appreciate how thoughtful they're being about this, and making it clear that, yes, she will get there, but she doesn't want to disturb, because those emergency resources need to be used for the people on the ground. And the best thing that she can do is make sure that the money is going to flow as quickly and as effortlessly out of D.C. into those areas that are hardest hit.
And Charlie Sykes, even if it was her desire to be on the ground, what local officials are really pleading with, according to Politico Playbook, is that folks don't come. Quote, the people in my district really don't want to see politicians, said Republican Representative Chuck Edwards, whose mountainous Western North Carolina district has been ravaged by flooding. Quote, they want to see water, food, cell towers, and power restored, and the ability to contact their loved ones. Photo ops are not what's needed. North Carolina's Democratic Governor Roy Cooper agreed. Quote, I told the president that we did not need elected officials that require a lot of security and attention, because we need to make sure that we're getting the work done on the ground. People are still trapped. It's not the right time for them to come. Charlie.
Well, somebody ought to send that that memo to Donald Trump, because he is going to be there and he's going to try to exploit this. He's already making up stories about the administration not being accessible. Look, as you well know, Nicole, events like this are a major test of presidential leadership, and they can be decisive. You know, I'm listening and watching some of the Republican commentators saying this is going to be the Biden-Harris Katrina all over again. Well, not necessarily. I think that there's a little bit of projection going on there. I remember how the Obama administration handled Sandy back in 2012, and that was something that I think helped them. And I'm sorry to put this in political terms, but it's almost inevitable to do that. Look, they have to be as aggressive as possible. They have to be as visible as possible. And I understand that they don't want to be a distraction. But the reality is that presidential leadership requires presence. And at some point, they have to demonstrate that they are in charge and that they are, in fact, present to this national disaster. I'm not saying that they need to be, you know, doing the kind of, and I think the contrast with the Trumpian approach is going to be rather dramatic. You know, he's going to be throwing fish sticks. He's going to be throwing paper towels. They have to be there substantively providing aid and making it clear exactly what the federal government is going to do to help Americans who are in need. This is one of those moments where Americans are going to look at the government and say, can you get the job done? Are you competent? Are you strong? And are you caring about it? And again, at some point, presence has to be part of that.
Georgia is continuing its efforts to assess the damage left behind by Helene. Earlier today, Governor Brian Kemp said the death toll has reached 25, and that is up from 17 over the weekend. Kemp is calling the destruction an unprecedented situation.
This hurricane, it looks like a 250-mile wide tornado has hit. The thing that's unusual about this storm is unprecedented for a Cat 2 hurricane to actually make landfall in Georgia, and to see the level of the destruction that a hurricane could do in this community, being this far from Lowndes County or Eccles County in the Florida line is unprecedented.
CBS News correspondent Scott McFarland is in Valdosta, Georgia, following the Trump campaign. So thanks for joining us. Why don't you walk us through the backdrop of the visit today with former President Trump and what's expected there?
Yeah, behind me is the backside of a destroyed business, part of the epicenter of this path of destruction of Helene through this part of South Central Georgia. The former president has this whole setup around us here for a set of remarks and a photo op that happened mid-afternoon here in Valdosta, Georgia. But this is a city still hemorrhaging from the impacts of the hurricane. Schools are closed in a radius around this area. Power remains out likely through the rest of the week. Businesses are closed, and there is an initial recovery underway from the hurricane. We know former president is going to criticize the federal government response, the Biden administration response to this part of Helene's path of destruction and North Carolina's destruction. Going to criticize the Biden administration for how it's handled the initial days of this. That criticism has not been echoed by the federal representatives of this area. The federal response is just beginning. But the former president, to a degree, is capitalizing on the vice president being far away on a West Coast campaign trip, and the president just returning to D.C. from Delaware. That does raise the risk of instilling in this disaster response a heavy dose of politics, but it's a calculation he's making here in Valdosta today.
Scott, I can't help but wonder about the logistics of security. Even getting around right now for anyone is difficult. So how do they manage protecting the former president?
Well, it's a real dicey situation because we're in a very fresh disaster zone and they're trying to put a perimeter of security that is enhanced due to the recent assassination attempts. We're surrounded by large trucks providing a visual cover for this area, snipers on top of highway overpasses, on top of some of the barriers they put in place. We don't see the bulletproof glass, which has newly been used for Donald Trump behind me, but he hasn't arrived yet. The possibility that comes with his Secret Service detail. We do notice that when you drive through town, you see all the toppled billboards, toppled trees, all the traffic lights are out. There is a pretty heavy police presence here. We spoke with some of the businesses downtown who said, it's fine that there's a dignitary visiting. It's fine that there's a security response to it, but that is not the focus of this city. They're focused on recovery right now.
Absolutely. Scott McFarland, Scott, thank you for being there for us and reporting. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris is cutting her campaign trip short in Las Vegas and will be heading to Washington to meet with FEMA officials. CBS News campaign reporter Nydia Cavazos joins us live from Las Vegas now. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you walk us through the plans and the storm zone? What's the team saying?
Well, we know that Vice President Harris and her team are in the middle of trying to plan a visit to the impacted areas, but we know that this visit is going to come only if it's not disruptive to emergency response operations going on. This is the latest that we're hearing from the Vice President's team. Now, we don't know if it'll come this week. What we do know is that Vice President Harris is on the campaign trail. She was supposed to have several stops today in Vegas, trying to court up several key demographics in the state, but she had to cut the short to head back to D.C. Now, last night during her rally here in Vegas, Nevada, Harris did address the situation, telling her crowd that herself and President Biden had already spoken to local and state officials, telling them that they will have the necessary resources to aid them in this rescue and recovery effort and for as long as it is necessary. Now, Harris did ask for thoughts and prayers, as this is a catastrophic situation, and we do expect that the death toll will be rising in the upcoming days.
All right. Thank you so much for that update. Appreciate it.
After Hurricane Helene left a path of destruction across the southeast over the weekend, homeowners and businesses are seeking to rebuild, and that could be costly. Moody's Analytics is predicting the storm will cause $15 to $26 billion in property damage alone, and AccuWeather estimates the total damage and economic loss could cost up to $110 billion. These figures would make Helene one of the most expensive storms in the country's history. Mark Friedlander joins us for more. He's a spokesperson for the Insurance Information Institute. Mark, thank you for being with us. So homeowners affected by the storms will be scrambling to make claims soon. Give us a sense of what that process is like. It seems like a huge challenge for the insurance companies. And then what would that do to prices for premiums and just the general overall insurance market?
While there are a lot of projections out there, John, from an insured perspective, this is not going to be a major loss event. In fact, the catastrophe modelers have indicated the loss range for private insurers will run about $5 billion to $8 billion. That's very small for a Category 4 landfalling hurricane compared to Hurricane Ian 2 years ago, which was about a $50 billion insured loss event.
So help me understand the delta or the difference between estimates of it costing $110 billion, but then that number $5 billion to $8
billion. The full scope includes economic impacts. It doesn't include insured losses. And unfortunately, what we're seeing here is many of the losses incurred, especially in southern Appalachia, parts of Georgia, other states further away from the coast, are flood losses that are not covered by insurance. The average take-up rate for flood insurance in these areas is under 1%. So sadly, many of the victims of the storm do not have insurance coverage for this loss.
Wow. And so they're out of luck. What about federal programs for flood loss? Is there any help they can get outside of the private insurance market?
Typically with these type of disasters, John, FEMA offers a emergency grant program that individuals and families can apply for. However, that's not a replacement for insurance. You might get a small sum to help you begin the recovery, but a FEMA grant is not going to repair or rebuild your home. It is not a substitute for insurance. And unfortunately, flood insurance, is the largest gap we see across the country right now. Only about 6% of U.S. homeowners have a flood policy. And in many of these hard-hit areas, as I said, it's under 1% of the residents.
So if you're damaged, this seems blindingly obvious, but I'll ask it anyway. If your home is damaged by the water and you don't have flood insurance, you're out of luck. If a tree falls on it and splits it in half and you're covered, then you're covered.
Wind damage is covered by a standard home renters or condo insurance policy. Flood damage or storm surge, which is also flood, those are only covered by flood insurance.
By specific insurance for that. Okay, well, that's very helpful. Mark Friedlander with the Insurance Information Institute. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thanks for having me, John.
Charleroi once again evoked by former President Donald Trump when speaking at a campaign rally in Indiana, talking specifically about immigration. Tonight, locals weighing in on their reality in Charleroi.
Would you say your town has changed just a little bit over the last couple of months?
Former President Donald Trump speaking to Charleroi residents about immigration in their town from the rally stage Monday night.
In Charleroi, Pennsylvania, has seen a 2,000% increase in the population of their town. Do you know that, right? Has your town changed slightly?
Borough Council member Larry Salasky clarifying that stat applies to the immigrant population, which is around 2,500. Resident Tom Altmiller says his concern is that the population has grown, but businesses are leaving.
It's not a good deal for them either. I'm not here to castigate our Haitian population. I'm here to say that this wasn't good for anybody.
Longtime business owner and former mayor of Charleroi sees the growing immigrant population as a positive.
I'm excited to see the businesses being filled. These people are coming in legally, and that's what people are missing the boat on. This is all legal people. We're not talking about illegal immigrants here. We're talking about people who are trying to escape something bad to come to something better in their life.
Council President Kristen Hopkins-Kalsick said Charleroi should be looked at as an example of how a community navigates this situation successfully. Charleroi is currently home to 44 different nationalities. And in regard to Haitian immigrants, the population is on, quote, temporary protected status, which allows them to legally live and work here, something Altmiller questions.
Is it possible to extend it once, twice, indefinitely?
Jean-Claude Francois immigrated from Haiti to New York many years ago before moving to Charleroi, where he buys blighted properties and rehabilitates them.
All the Haitians come here for a better life. That's what they come here for. They could stay in their country if it was peaceful.
Reporting in Charleroi, Kaylee Gunderson, Pittsburgh's Action News 4.
Thank you for listening today.
What if the second deadliest cancer in men and women could be prevented? Would you try to avoid the pain? And what if you could protect yourself without leaving your home? Colorectal cancer is highly preventable. Screening is important, safe, and most people have options. Ask your doctor which screening test is right for you. Learn more from the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at getscreened.org.
Know a veteran who needs help? Nation's Finest provides supportive services to veterans and their families who are struggling with housing-related costs. Visit nationsfinest.org or call 1-833-468-9676. That's 1-833-468-9676.
You're listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh. And you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. My name is Steve, your host for the Deep Blues Hour. 60 minutes of classic and traditional blues. And in this hour, we're going to hear from Roosevelt Sykes on piano, talking about his funky side. Carrie Robinson will join us as well. If you don't know Carrie, well, she was a performer on Maxwell Street on the south side of Chicago. We'll hear from her from back in the 1960s. And right about the same time, we'll hear from a legend of the Delta Blues, Mr. Son House, with his classic Motherless Children. It's all coming up here on this hour of the Deep Blues Hour. We're going to kick things off with Boo Boo Davis from a Black and Tan release called Can Man. Here he is with Headache. Boo Boo Davis here on the Deep Blues Hour.
some gotcha dog just to relieve this pain. I don't want you to worry, babe. I don't want you to worry at all. I don't want you to worry, babe. I don't want you to worry at all. I don't want you to worry at all.
WRCT is supported by Spack Brothers Pizza, located at 5107 Penn Avenue in Bloomfield. Spack Brothers Pizza offers pizza, hoagies, and wings, and salads, while specializing in vegan and vegetarian alternatives. Spack Brothers Pizza uses no refined sugars in its sauce and unbleached flour in its dough. Spack Brothers is currently online only and offers both takeout and delivery. For more information, email spackhelp@gmail.com or visit their website, spackbrothers.com. If you are interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities.
Been gone. Yeah, kitty, kitty, kitty.
Mr. Cedric Burnside and Lightnin' Malcolm from their 2008 Delta Groove release called Two Man Wrecking Crew. Really excellent release there from Cedric and Lightnin'. That was called Nobody Else. Plus, we heard from Big Jack Johnson, one-third of the Jelly Roll Kings, from his release entitled Roots Stew. That was Too Many Rats from Big Jack Johnson. Chop Shop, it's confusing sound for a confusing time, and it's Saturday night from 5 p.m. It's time for Chop Shop, only on WRCT. And if someone in your home swallows something that might be poisonous, or you think that they took too much of something that might hurt them, well, what do? Call your local poison center at 1-800-222-1222. It'll connect you to the poison center serving your area. Did you memorize that? It's 1-800-222-1222. A public service message from WRCT and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We're going to hear next from T-Bone Walker out in California. Here he is with You're My Best Poker Hand from 1949. T-Bone here on the Deep Blues Hour.
I've got a five-card heart and I don't know how to play. I need a queen like you to make my hand okay. They kid drew aces and stacked them back to back. The kid drew aces and stacked them back to back. I looked at my hand and not a smile did I crack. Drawed one card. When the deal goes down, I've only drawed one card. And if you play poker, you know that sure is hard. The kid spread his hand and then began to blush. The kid spread his hand and then began to blush. But his face turned pale when he saw my queen high flush.
I'm going to do a piece that I wrote celebrating James Booker as a New Orleans pianist, and it's entitled Dr. James. Yeah. Thank you.
that evening. Train been gone. Baby, go. Get up on one of these tall mountains. Call my baby back.
Dr. Kenya on the air, feel the vibe, feel the vibe. Timber sounds moving on side to side, side to side. Culture being fire grooves all night long, all night long. Dance floors live here, the song come along, come along. Feel the bass, hear the drums, let it flow, let it flow. Tempers up, vibe is hot, here we go, here we go. From the south to the west, every beat, every beat. Dr. Kenya's got
got the sound for